This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In 1981, just 27 years ago, an African-American teenager named Michael Donald was murdered by two members of the Ku Klux Klan who slit his throat and hung his body from a tree in Mobile, Alabama. They were sending a message. In a new documentary called The Last Lynching that airs tonight on the Discovery Channel, Ted Koppels tells the story of Michael Donald and his mother. He interviews one of his killers and talks with Congressman Arthur Davis, who worked on this case as a young civil rights attorney and who, this summer, seconded the nomination of the first African-American to win the presidential nomination of a major American political party. We'll talk with Ted Koppel, Congressman Davis, and with a professor for whom lynching is more than U.S. history. It's family history. Later in the hour, William Kristol joins us on the opinion page in today's New York Times. He argues that John McCain should fire his campaign just 3 weeks before Election Day. But first, if lynching is part of your family story on either side, our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also share your story on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Many Mondays, we talk with Ted Koppel about international news. Today, he joins us from his home in Maryland to talk about his documentary for the Discovery Channel, The Last Lynching. And Ted, as always, nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you, Neil. Always good to be with you.
And let's begin with that message. What was the message sent when James Tiger Knowles and Henry Hayes lynched Michael Donald?
Well, they were both members of the Ku Klux Klan. This event occurred at a time when a black man was on trial for murder. The charge was that he had killed a white police officer. And the jury, which was predominantly black, it was a hung jury, and so the defendant walked. And members of the Klan, leaders of the Klan in Mobile, wanted to send a message to the black community that they couldn't get away with this kind of thing, which indeed is what the Klan and groups like the Klan have been doing for generations in this country. Lynchings were rarely just random acts of violence. As often as not, they were calculated acts of terrorism that were intended to send a political message, and the political message, as much as anything else, was if you people think you're going to be part of the political process in this town, in this village, in this state, you've got another thing coming. So these two young men were sent out with the mission of just lynching a black man. It didn't really matter who. Michael was unfortunate enough, he was only 19 years old at the time, to respond to a query about where a particular restaurant might be. He leaned over into the car where these two young Klansmen were. They dragged him into the car at gunpoint, took him off into the bayou, beat him, slit his throat, and then brought him back and hanged him from a tree. Right across from the home of the local Klan leader. So the message was anything but subtle. Nevertheless, it took the Mobile Police Department 2 or 3 years before they got over their initial impression, which was that this was a drug-related killing.
And you tie this story, and there are a couple of other stories you also tell in this documentary, but this story, first of all, astonishing that it was 1981, and so close to our memories that it has very live connections to the Democratic Convention that was held in Denver this summer.
Well, Arthur Davis, who, as you said, is going to be joining us, is, I believe, and he will correct me if I'm wrong, still the only black congressman from Alabama. But he represents Birmingham and Selma. Birmingham, which during the 1960s used to be known as Bombingham. When I think of being down in that part of the country, as I was often covering civil rights stories in the early mid-60s, it is astonishing to me that we are where we are today. Having said that, there continues to be a significant amount of racism in this country, and we wanted to draw attention both to the past and to the more recent past.
Well, as you mentioned, joining us now from member station WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama, is Congressman Arthur Davis. He represents the 7th District of Alabama and is featured in the documentary, the Discovery documentary, The Last Lynching. And Congressman Davis, nice to have you on the program today with us.
Neil, thank you. Glad to be on the program and glad to be in the company of Ted Koppel again.
And what is your connection to the Michael Donald case?
Well, frankly, my connection is a little bit on the peripheral side. I worked as a young law student for the Southern Poverty Law Center. The Southern Poverty Law Center is a legal advocacy organization in Montgomery, Alabama, that has done an enormous amount of good work since its inception in the 1970s. The Southern Poverty Law Center brought a civil suit on behalf of Mr. Donald, and they recovered. At that time, the first judgment that ever been recovered in the country against the Ku Klux Klan, and they had a very novel and interesting legal theory that this wasn't simply a random act of violence by a few crazed Klansmen, but that this was something that flew out of the philosophy and out of the direction and, if you will, out of the management structure of the Ku Klux Klan. They had to prove those things to hold the Klan liable as an organization. They were successful, and after that, they went on to do a series of other lawsuits. When I worked at the center as an intern in 1992, the center was involved in collecting some judgments that they had obtained in some cases in Oregon against some skinheads out there. Hmm. And it was the same legal theory that the national skinheads were directing the violence of individual skinheads in particular places. A very important organization that pursued a very important legal theory that helped break the back of the Ku Klux Klan as an active and vital force in American life.
And led, I might add, as I'm sure Congressman Davis would want me to, by an exceptional man, a white Southerner by the name of Morris Dees, who was the creative genius behind this notion, this legal notion, which Congressman Davis has conceded to me. Nobody really thought it had a snowball's chance of succeeding, but it did. And it did a lot of good in that sense.
And you also point out, Congressman Davis, in the film that, you know, we think of lynching as something that occurs with, you know, Panama hats and seersucker suits and old black and white images. This, as you point out, happened in the era of color television.
All too recent. And I make the point in the documentary that sometimes young people have this mindset that anything, there are only black and white pictures of it. It happened a long time ago. If it's color, it's fairly recent. And we think, well, lynchings and the explicit violence that we associate with the 30s and 40s and 50s, well, just that. We think that that's a long ago time frame. The reality is that some of this violence spilled into a much closer period of time. 1981 wasn't that long ago. Unless you think a 27-year-old person's an old person, 1981 is not that long ago. And I'm glad that the Discovery Channel did this documentary. I'm glad Ted Koppel got interested in this story because it's not one that most Americans know. Most Americans have never heard of Donald. Most Americans are not aware that a lynching from a tree happened in 1981. And it's important for us to remember that because as we obviously may be on the verge of a remarkable political event happening in this country with Barack Obama's nomination and possible election to the presidency in a few weeks, we still ought to be reminded, as Ted points out, that racism has never disappeared as a factor in American life. The most active, overt kinds of racism have never disappeared. And you can't fully understand where we've come as a country unless you have some grounding in the recency of the struggle.
We're talking with Congressman Arthur Davis and with Ted Koppel, whose documentary, The Last Lynching, airs tonight on the Discovery Channel. If you'd like to call us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Kay is on the line. Kay calling us from Tallahassee in Florida.
Hi. Love your show. Listen to it all the time.
Thank you.
Hope you're well.
Thank you.
I was calling because this is an issue that was close to my family once when my brother and I were young, younger, growing up in the late 70s, early 80s. Our grandfather, who was raised in a town between Tallahassee and Jacksonville that will remain unnamed, talked about how, I guess just for kicks, they kidnapped a black person and took him out to an oak tree and just shot him. And I couldn't really understand the point of why he was telling us this. I'm sorry.
You might want to turn down the radio because it'll be less confusing.
It bothers me that there are people still like this out there that could endanger the progress of this country with the possibility of outcome of our election. And I hadn't heard about this incident in Mobile, but I hope we get past it soon.
And you were a kid, and your grandfather told you this. How did it make you feel?
Well, we were both distraught, me and my brother both. he was an old Southern white man. That was very much the mentality down here for many generations, and we were kind of brought up with it as a distance. I think the women of our family kind of made the men hush that kind of talk by the time we were going up, since we had already been a few years out from the Civil Rights Movement, and we were both upset by it. I don't know what, if he was just spinning yet another story like people of that generation did, but it was, we couldn't understand why he was telling us this, whether he was trying to forgive himself somehow or have us think like he did or whatever the purpose was. And I never brought it up, and I don't know if my brother ever brought it up with him. We never talked about it after it was over with, but just to think that we were attached to some kind of activity like that, and they had done this before his pre-World War II era days, and even though that was ages ago, it's very hard to think that you were just a generation or two away from that kind of activity.
Ages ago, but within living memory, I guess.
Yeah.
That's one of the points of your story and one of the points of Ted Koppel's film.
Yeah.
Kay, thank you very much for the phone call.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Appreciate the call. We're going to take more of your calls. When we come back from a short break, we're going to continue talking about the documentary The Last Lynching, which airs tonight on the Discovery Channel. Our guests, Ted Koppel and Congressman Arthur Davis, who as a young man worked on the case of Michael Donald, who was killed just 27 years ago and his body hung from a tree in Mobile, Alabama. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tonight, the Discovery Channel airs Ted Koppel's new documentary about the murder of Michael Donald. It's called The Last Lynching. We're talking with him this hour and with Congressman Arthur Davis, who represents the 7th District of Alabama. If lynching is part of your family story on either side, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And I wanted to ask you, Congressman Davis, you were a young man, mm-hmm. very young man, when this murder happened, and just a little mm-hmm. bit older when you worked on the case. Did you see this at that time as a relic? Did you see this as the last lynching?
No. Growing up in the South, unfortunately, you're all too accustomed to stories about racial violence. I grew up in Montgomery, Alabama. In 1983, there was a series of shootings of unarmed black men. There was an incident in which a couple of white undercover police officers became involved in an altercation with a black family. And to this day, no one knows exactly what happened, but we know if the black family was brutally beaten after they were taken into custody. That happened 2 years after Michael Donald's lynching. I grew up in a very racially polarized environment where blacks and whites were very much separated politically, economically, socially, legally, in terms of their legal prospects in the system. We're obviously a much better country and a much better state now. But I think, again, it's important for people to realize that, and anytime you assemble a collection of human beings, you're going to have a collection of malevolent impulses and noble impulses. Magnify that across a country of hundreds of millions of people, and you're going to have a lot of people who are very bad and a lot of people who are trying their best to move us toward our goal of being a more perfect union. Both the good and bad are part of the American narrative, and to fully understand our country, we have to talk about both. We have to talk about America at its best and at its worst.
Yet, certainly the nomination of Senator Obama has increased. We were all talking about race, and to some degree, we're focusing on some ugly ugly parts of us that we had sort of put aside, maybe. Is it good for us to look at ourselves that way, or does it worry you sometimes that this streak within us is coming out again?
Well, there were some ugly moments on the campaign trail last week. Unfortunately, we've come to the point in American politics where there are all too many ugly moments because of ideology, because of race. There's an author named Ron Perlstein who's written a wonderful book called Nixon Land, which makes the argument that for a period of time in the 1960s, early 1970s, a disconcertingly large number of Americans were killed at the hands of other Americans who killed them for one simple reason. They thought they were lesser beings because they disagreed with them over politics. Some of those slayings, we look back and we clearly see them as racial. Others, many Americans have never heard about, but they're more ideological in nature. But it's all a part of our recent history. The use of violence, as Ted Koppel pointed out, the use of violence to intimidate, to suppress people from getting engaged politically and getting engaged socially. And what the caller points to is just the randomization of violence. Ordinary people deciding that because they think other people are lesser beings than they are, that they can resort to violence and resort to using force against them. That is all too common a stream throughout our national history, and it's a stream that we need to recognize. Thankfully, it's not by any means the dominant part of who we are and had been for a very long time, but we need to know that that strain is still there.
Get another caller on the line. This is Madeline. Madeline with us from Philadelphia.
Yes, I'm in Philadelphia now, but I was from Mobile, Alabama, and I was on one of the capital murder jury trials for that lynching. It was one of the later ones, I think 1986, and as a lifelong resident of Mobile, I was just very, very proud to stand up to do the right thing, to let people know that there are Southerners who are courageous, who are brave, and who want to do the right thing, and always have been. I was very proud to stand up and do that at that time.
So was this the trial of Tiger Knowles or Henry Hayes?
It was for the accessories of the crime, and I don't remember the names. I think Tiger Knowles was already in the federal penitentiary at the time. I think there was the son-in-law of the Klan leader who was involved in the beating of the young man and one of his friends. I recall that they had stayed up all night playing cards. There was a small band of them. They were trying to revive the Klan. They met at a Kentucky Fried Chicken once a week in Theodore, Alabama. And they kept talking about how they wanted to get, and they used a slang term. And finally they got up their nerve and did so, and then spent the rest of that night playing cards in their bloodstained clothes, if I recall correctly. And then when the gentleman who lived on Herndon Avenue, and the man who lived on Herndon Avenue, got up in the morning, he saw what had been done, if I recall correctly, and it's been quite a while.
Sure. Ted Koppel, I wanted to ask you, there's an extraordinary scene in your documentary. One of those men, one of the killers of Michael Donald was Tiger Knowles, that's his nickname, of course, and was someone who came to regret his actions and turned to state's evidence and testified against his accomplices. And there's an extraordinary moment from the film. We're going to play a clip from the movie now. And this is where he turns to Michael Donald's mother just before a sentence is pronounced.
I asked Mrs. Donald to forgive me for what I had done. And I begged her to forgive me because I couldn't bring him back. And she did. She forgave me. In front of everyone. After that, it didn't matter what anyone else thought. My mom and dad, who were there, I cared about them. I know they were crying. But I was talking to Mrs. Donald. I couldn't bring her son back. I couldn't change anything that had happened. And she forgave me. She forgave me in front of God and everybody. That's all that mattered.
Pretty amazing moment.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. She was a pretty amazing woman. Excuse me.
And Ted Koppel, we can't forget that this is as much her story as her son's.
Indeed, but I want to go back to the caller you had a moment ago, because the lady is absolutely right, and the point deserves to be made and reemphasized. In the civil trial, and that's actually the one that I think Tiger Knowles was talking about, where he apologized directly to the mother of the man that he had killed, in that civil trial, there was a deliberate effort on Morris D's part and on the part of the Southern Poverty Law Center to have an all-white jury. Morris Dees most especially wanted an all-white jury to make exactly the point that that lady was making. And that is that times have changed, people's mindset has changed, and that it would be possible for an all-white Southern jury to bring in an appropriate verdict in this case. And they did. And there is another point that needs to be made, and that is a generational one. And that goes back to your earlier caller who recalled that conversation with her grandfather. Things have changed in the United States, but I think it's no accident that Barack Obama has such a huge following among young people, among whom I would say there is a great deal less racism today than there is among middle-aged and older people in this country. Where racism still exists, it tends to exist more among older Americans than younger Americans, and that's a good thing.
Madeline, you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Does he have that right?
He absolutely does have it right, and I'm just so proud that the story is being told and that Ted Koppel is telling it, because we have to move on. I think Southerners want to move on and want to do the right thing, and that's what we've got to do. We've got to stand up and always do the right thing, no matter how hard it is.
Madeline, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Joining us now from Post Digital Recording Studios in Las Vegas, Nevada, is Todd Robinson, a professor of African American and U.S. history at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And thank you very much for being with us today.
It's good to join you, Neil, Tom, and also Congressman Davis.
And I know that you, as part of your studies, lynching and African-American history, inextricably intertwined, also, though, a part of your family history.
Absolutely. We had an incident in July 4th of 1930 whereby two of our family members were lynched in ML, Alabama, in Sumner County, by a mob of roughly 50 people. My grandfather was a young man at that time, and he fled for his life and was actually taken in by a white family who refused to let the mob search their home. And because of that, our family was able to continue on.
There is such enormous drama and such pain involved in these stories. How do you tell your students today about it in a way that makes it meaningful for them, in a way that makes it not seem as though this was the distant past?
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm very happy that Ted Koppel's put together this piece. This is such a deeply rooted part of American history. I often phrase it as America's favorite pastime. I mean, it involved more than 50 people at different points in time for the lynching. Sometimes crowds numbered as high as 10,000 plus. People got dressed in their Sunday best. They enjoyed cocktails and watched the dismembering of black bodies and the devaluing of black bodies. In the case of my family, Esau Robinson had his eyes picked out with an ice pick. They dismembered other body parts, and they proceeded to keep those body parts as souvenirs, as memorabilia for a day well spent, if you will. And as you probably know, there were numerous postcards that traveled freely in the mail that memorialized these occasions and as a triumph of white superiority. So I try to tell it in a way that's very real and also talk about the context of generational racism or the transference of racial ideologies, which is works both ways. You can witness that particular lynching or incidents or hear stories along those lines and go a different way. But in the case of Hayes, his father was also a former member of the KKK, and he followed his father's pathway.
This was one of the men who murdered Michael Donald, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I wonder, we are, as Congressman Davis has said, he comes from a state that is better than it was 27 years ago. The country is better than it was then. Yet it is certainly not a perfect country, by far from a perfect union. Do you worry sometimes as we have the nomination of an African-American for the highest office in the land, that if Barack Obama should win the election, some people worry that white America will then conclude, well, this is done, this is over with, this has been accomplished.
I know that's a concern among a number of people, and certainly I hold that reservation to a certain extent. We need to acknowledge that there has been progress in America, certainly, but Barack Obama's historical first does not erase racism. It's not necessarily as overt. There's certainly covert actions of it. That being said, I mean, the recent incidents in Oregon with the mock lynching of Obama let you know that there are still real sentiments there that deeply divide this society. And in actuality, I think the last lynching might have been in 1998 with James Byrd in Jasper, Texas. And then again, we see another instance of the overt context of this racial divide in America. Hopefully, with the case of Governor Wilder in Virginia in 1989, people are talking about the Bradley effect. Hopefully, Barack Obama and Americans can actually step up and assess this situation on merit alone and not use race as a barometer to judge.
We're talking.
Neil, may I jump in on that?
If you could give me just a moment. We're talking with Todd Robinson, with Congressman Arthur Davis, and Ted Koppel. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Congressman, go ahead, please.
No, I just wanted to make a quick point following up on the professor's observation. What Senator Obama's election will mean is that a highly gifted, highly talented individual who's running in the perfect political climate where the party he's running against has been discredited and has an unpopular president can be elected. And we still don't know what the margin will be. By definition, that is a somewhat limited story. It doesn't tell you a whole lot about the prospects of young black men on the south side of Chicago or young black men who are living in Sumter County, which, by the way, I represent, the county where the lynching occurred, the professor described. In that particular county today, something like 31% of the blacks who live in that county live below the poverty line. Something like 42% of the black men in that county live below the poverty line. And a disconcertingly large number of them, well over a third of the black men in that county, at some point will come into contact with the criminal justice system during their lifetimes. That will be the case even if there's a black man in the White House. When Governor Wilder won in Virginia 20 years ago, it didn't mean that racism disappeared in Virginia. And for that matter, Senator Obama's being a senator from Illinois doesn't mean that racism doesn't exist in Illinois. I think what we have to understand is the story of race is a divided one in our country. It's always so many steps forward, so many steps backward at the same time. But what I do hope will happen if Obama is successful is that it will move us into a window where white Americans are more willing to contemplate the idea that a black American could lead or could represent their interests and not just the interests of black people. But it will always be a divided, mixed story when we talk about race.
And Congressman Davis, I'm glad you inserted the if. It is 3 weeks to Election Day, so
that's right.
we note your prediction, but it is still 3 weeks out.
Right.
Ted Koppel, let me ask you, we just have a couple of minutes left, but I did want to ask you, other people have told us why they thought it was important for you to do this film at this particular time. Why did you make this film at this particular time? We started talking about messages. What is your message?
Well, I think an appropriate message, Neil, perhaps to leave this story on, is the notion that bigotry, unfortunately, is always it expands and it contracts almost simultaneously. We elect Jack Kennedy president, and there is a temptation to say, well, anti-Catholicism has ended. Clearly, it had not. If Senator Obama is elected president, there will be a tendency to feel that there is less racism against blacks. I think that would be a justifiable conclusion, but at the same time, remember that people are making a great deal of the fact that it's Barack Hussein Obama. And when you say Hussein and you leave the impression in people's minds that he either is a Muslim or has a Muslim connection, what that reflects is the extraordinary bigotry that is growing in some circles in this country against Muslims. The fact that it is a different kind of bigotry doesn't make it any better. And before we start congratulating ourselves too much on how far we've come, I think at the same time we need to be on an even keel looking ahead and saying we still have a ways to go.
Indeed. Let us thank our guests. Todd Robinson, appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
Todd Robinson, Assistant Professor of African American and U.S. History at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, with us from a studio there in Las Vegas. Congressman Arthur Davis, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Davis, Congress represents the 7th District of Alabama, with us today from the studios of member station WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama. Ted Koppel joined us from his home in Maryland. And, Ted, next time, let's talk about North Korea.
That's an idea.
Ted Koppel with us many Mondays here on Talk of the Nation. Coming up, Weekly Standard editor Bill Kristol joins us on the opinion page with some advice for John McCain. Fire your campaign. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now time for the Talk of the Nation opinion page. Over the last week or so, as the gap in the presidential opinion polls grows, many prominent conservatives are shaking their heads in dismay and offering advice to Republican John McCain, including William Kristol, who wrote in his column in the New York Times today that it's time for Senator McCain to fire his campaign. So McCain supporters 3 weeks and a day from the election, what can the Republican nominee do to come from behind? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation, where you'll find a link to William Kristol's latest column, Fire the Campaign. In addition to his Times column, Bill Kristol is the editor of the Weekly Standard. He joins us today from the ABC radio studios here in Washington. Nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And you argue that at this point, Senator McCain does not have a lot to lose.
Right. I mean, if they spend the next 3 weeks sort of campaign versus campaign, the Obama campaign has much more in the way of resources. They're much better organized, and they've just shown a better ability to sort of fight in the traditional campaigning modes. They have better TV ads. I think their message is more coherent. The candidate and the campaign are more in sync. So I think McCain will lose if it just becomes a sort of normal 3 weeks. He has to change the dynamics. And I think the greatest strength of the McCain campaign is John McCain. He's an attractive, impressive human being. Lots of Americans have warm sentiments towards him. He should liberate himself. He should have press conferences every day. He should throw open the Straight Talk Express, whether it's a bus or a plane, let the media mingle with the media, just do tons of radio and TV and kind of go back to a free-form effort. It's not the traditional way you win a presidential race, but he's not going to win it if he keeps running a traditional campaign.
So you have to come to the conclusion that whatever it is they've been doing thus far, at least since they closed the door on the Straight Talk Express, well, that hasn't been working.
Yeah, it hasn't. I mean, I think they're, it's not an indictment of the people there. It's a tough year for Republicans, and Obama is a very impressive candidate, and the economic crisis over the last 3-4 weeks was sort of unexpected, and at that point McCain had tightened the race. But they are where they are, and I think one part of political intelligence is to realize that things aren't working and to be willing to make the changes you've got to make.
Yet Senator McCain has tried to change the dynamic a couple of times, first by naming Governor Palin to be his vice presidential candidate, a surprise selection, and then later as the economic story, particularly the bill in Washington, became such huge news, suspending his campaign to come to Washington. And those had minor effects at various times, but the pass may have been caught, but it wasn't the Hail Mary.
Right. And I think in both cases, actually, I don't think they were bad moves. And I think they reflected good instincts, really. But he didn't follow through. He named Sarah Palin. She got off to a great start with the convention speech. Then they sort of got nervous and locked her up and let her do only two high-profile interviews with Charlie Gibson and Katie Couric with great pressure on her. Instead of just saying, you know what, you're an effective politician, you're an effective communicator, you don't know as much as Senator Biden about the details of foreign policy, but you can explain that you have good, sensible views and you'll have very capable people around you. You'll be vice president, not president. I think they should have just thrown her out and let her sink or swim. I think she would have swam fine. They'd be better off with that. On the coming back to Washington in the middle of the the fight over the bailout package, I don't think it was a bad instinct to think that John McCain could show leadership there if he could have pulled people together and gotten a better package passed. But they hadn't thought it through. I mean, this campaign has been, and they're friends of mine in it, so I don't like saying this, but it's been so tactical and so unstrategic. They don't seem to think beyond the second or third day. And when he came back, I said, good idea. Now I guess they figured out whether he will or won't go to the debate the next night. You remember all those issues that were pending. And instead, they were doing it on the fly. And so they ended up looking kind of frazzled and betwixt and between. And the same with Palin. I think she's doing fine now. But they, in a way, took a lot of the lost some of the advantage, I think, of a bold pick. So, look, those were interesting choices. I don't argue with either. But at the end of the day, he is who he is. McCain is who he is. He's 72 years old. He's an impressive man. I think he should go out just presenting himself to the American public. Get rid of the TV ads. They're not working anyway. Save the money. Do a half-hour speech to the public. Put some town halls on live on TV. really run an unorthodox last 3 weeks. It probably won't work, frankly, but I think he'd be much happier doing it. And I think there's a chance it would work because he still has a pretty compelling case, in my view, and I'm a little biased, to make to the American public. You know, he's a credible president. People aren't crazy about having, I think, a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress. There are doubts about Senator Obama, who's, you know, more inexperienced than your typical presidential nominee. And McCain has a shot, but he's got to somehow throw off this kind of shadow boxing, tactical, you know, jabbing at each other campaigning and represent himself to the American public, I think.
Enjoying himself or being happy with himself, that's interesting. We forget that Ronald Reagan was behind in his campaign against Jimmy Carter until that debate and came off. Well, he had such a sunny personality. There are parts of John McCain that are not dissimilar.
That's right. And, you know, it gets to the question of attacking Senator Obama. I don't have moral problems or political problems with criticizing your opponent. And I think some of those criticisms, I think many of the criticisms that he's made of Obama have been legitimate, or certainly within the bounds of the normal political criticisms, as legitimate as criticisms Senator Obama's campaign has made of McCain. But if you're going to make them coherently, explain them, explain why it matters that he was on a board with Bill Ayers, for example. Don't just say sort of Bill Ayers, you know, that's terrible, and then kind of move on. You end up with the worst of both worlds. You look sort of mean-spirited and short-tempered, and you don't really prosecute your argument. The truth is McCain is not naturally an attack dog type of politician. If he's not going to prosecute the argument, just drop it. Just drop it. My recommendation to McCain would be almost to ignore Senator Obama. He's a fine person. It's impressive what he's accomplished so far. But let me make my case. Let me litigate my case to the American public. I think he'd be much better off doing that Wednesday night in the debate instead of looking as if he's sort of snapping at Senator Obama without actually laying out much of a coherent argument against him.
Passions run high in politics, especially toward the end of campaign. Some Democrats have said some nasty things about Governor Palin. Some Republicans have shouted out some ugly things about Senator Obama at a town meeting on Friday. Senator McCain responded to one of his supporters after she shouted out, he's an Arab. Let's listen to this tape.
I got to ask you a question. I do not believe in, I can't trust Obama. I have read about him, and he's an Arab. He is not.
No, ma'am. He's a decent family man, citizen that I just happen to have disagreements with on fundamental issues, and that's what this campaign is all about. He's not. Thank you.
Some had called on Senator McCain to respond that way a little bit earlier as some of those comments came out. I think he did himself some good there.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, look, you can't respond to every comment that's made, you know, after the fact, sort of by alleged supporters of yours all around the country. But I think when it's made, obviously, to your face or in your presence, you respond. And I think Senator McCain has. Actually, you know, for all the talk about bitterness and hatred, and there have been some very nasty and unpleasant things said by supporters on both sides, I would say that McCain, Obama, I would say all four of them, actually, Biden and Palin, are pleasant individuals, actually, who have a certain joy of politics and have conducted this campaign in a pretty responsible manner. I mean, if you think of previous campaigns and what's happened in some of those, I think actually the candidates themselves have behaved pretty well. And as I say, I think especially with McCain, I think his great virtue is that sense that he is willing to put aside petty politics. He's done stuff across the aisle in a bipartisan way. It's a big campaign. You know, with the issue now is so big with the economic crisis and the foreign policy challenges we face. And I think the tragedy of the McCain campaign is that it seems to have gotten a little bit smaller as the challenges facing the country have gotten bigger. I think the only way he can elevate his campaign is almost by, metaphorically, I say fire the campaign, but, you know, in a sense, putting aside all the normal campaign stunts, staffers, and advice, and just saying, you know what, I'm just going to make my case for why I think I can lead this country for the next 4 or 8 years.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. Our guest on the opinion page, William Crystal, editor of the Weekly Standard and an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. Let's turn to Ted, and Ted on the line with us from Las Vegas in Nevada.
Hey, how are you, gentlemen? You know, as a longtime Republican supporter of John McCain, I've met him at different rallies. He's a great guy, and I agree with Bill Crystal that he's got to do something to turn this around. I'm hoping that Liechtenstein invades France. he's going to need something like that to save this campaign, because this really reminds me of 1992 when the elder Bush was running against a young guy named Bill Clinton, who he kind of dismissed as a hippie from the 60s, and, you know, he was the comeback kid, and he steamrolled over Bush. And I feel the same sort of dynamics are in play here with the momentum that Obama has. And I don't know what McCain can do. I almost think that the events that are happening now are sort of beyond his control. And they also play into the fact that every 8 years, we sort of turn the pillow over and change parties.
Throw the bums out, and there's not much that he can do.
Yeah, I mean, I think the 12-year stretch of Republicanism was very different. It was a real fluke because George W. Bush was following on the heels of Ronald Reagan, a very popular president, and at the time, the country was much more economically stable.
Mm. Bill Kristol, does John McCain have any choice except to run against, in a way, the president of his own party? And obviously, people see that inconsistency.
Well, he has to distinguish himself from Bush, but I think he can do that pretty well. I think the caller's right. It's tough to hold the White House for a third term, and this massive economic crisis has helped the out party, which the Democrats are, or at least out of the White House party. They obviously control Congress now, but they don't get the same degree of blame as the president gets, and maybe justly so. But I would say this about McCain. Unlike I was part of that Bush 92 campaign, which was an abysmal failure. That was an incumbent campaign. The country wanted to change. I think McCain could take advantage of the fact that we're in a terrible crisis. I mean, no one blames John McCain for getting us in it. If anything, of the different candidates running, he probably warned the earliest about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, for example. And I think he needs to remind people why he, you know, that if you're in a crisis, you want someone of stature and experience and judgment and toughness to run the country. And in that respect, I think I agree he can't just be the Republican successor to George W. Bush. But again, the problem with the campaign is it's sort of running like a kind of typical Dole Bush Republican campaign, you know, attack ads on the Democrats. And again, I'm a Republican. I agree with a lot of the themes in those ads. I prefer Republican policies. But I think he has to somehow elevate the campaign and make it more about, well, who do you really trust to lead the country in dealing with these crises for the next 4 years? And it's not a matter of laying out a 10-point plan on this or an 8-point plan on this. No one knows what the next president's going to have to do on January 20th in terms of capital markets or, you know, the credit crunch or anything like that. He needs to just convey a sense of solidity and leadership and hope that voters at the end might say, you know, Senator Obama's an impressive guy, but maybe I'm more comfortable with Senator McCain over the next 4 years.
Ted, thanks very much for the call.
Take care.
You can find a link to William Kristol's column, Fire the Campaign, on our website at npr.org/blog of the nation. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Irfan on the line. Irfan from Chicago.
Gentlemen, how are you doing?
Good.
My question was here that McCain needs to come out more positive rather than negative. And kind of, as our guest said, that all this time he has attacked, he actually, like, took the message of change did not work. He took Bill Ayers. It did not work. He needs to reintroduce himself. Like, he has 3 weeks. He needs to go out in front of mirror and tell himself, I'm going to reintroduce myself to America again.
Yeah.
But he needs to talk about more bipartisan work. I heard the word bipartisan, but I did not hear, for example, he, like, I did this work. He needs to come out with examples that he did that for this country.
3 weeks, everybody says, a lifetime in politics, but it's a pretty short lifetime, Bill Kristol.
No, it is, and it may just be that this year was not fated to, you know, to elect a Republican to the White House for the third time. But I'm not. I think the caller's sort of right, though. This time, that one more debate's important. If the dynamic doesn't change after Wednesday night's debate at all, it's a little hard to see what big thing, unless some wild external event happens, right, will change the dynamic. But I think the key there for McCain, a lot of my friends are saying, I hope McCain really takes the glove off and goes after Obama. I just don't think he has it's not his style. He won't do it effectively if he tries to do it. And as I say, I think the key for McCain, I agree with the caller, is in a sense to think, okay, I've got 45 minutes, half the 90 minutes of the debate to sort of explain myself and make my case to the American public. I'm going to really do that in this debate.
Irfan, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Let's get another caller from Chicago. This is Michael.
Hi. I just wanted to ask Mr. Kristol about the sort of despicably temperate tone he strikes in his column. We've seen in the recent weeks one of the most, maybe the most poisonous and toxic developments in any presidential campaign in the last, say, 40 years, when we actually have people standing up at rallies for McCain in his presence, shouting for the death of the Democratic candidate for president of the United States. And Mr. Kristol's response is to suggest that McCain make a, quote, mild mea culpa at the debate on Wednesday. I'm sorry, but if I dare say that if Obama's supporters had been shouting that McCain was a traitor, a terrorist, shouting off with his head and shouting kill him, Mr. Crystal's column would be calling for a Justice Department investigation.
Let's see if we get a response from Bill Crystal.
No, it wouldn't be, because if you have an open town hall meeting, you can't control what random individuals say. I know, man, I myself have gone to watch a couple of McCain rallies, and I haven't been at any of these things where these terrible events have happened, but the ones I've been at have been good-natured and pro-McCain and well within the normal bounds of politics, and I think this is not the most despicable, hostile, or intemperate campaign of the last 40 years. In fact, these events that have gotten so much play in the last week have been really very few individuals, and as we, as the tape Neil played earlier showed, Senator McCain, when he was confronted by one woman, said, no, ma'am, that's not right, and went out of his way to praise Senator Obama.
And we're going to focus on this issue tomorrow, Michael, so I urge you to tune in then, okay?
All right.
All right. We just have a minute left. And Bill Crystal, we've been asking a lot of thinkers and writers this season to step back a moment and tell us what they think is at stake in this election. I hate to crowd this into the last minute, but I wonder, what do you think is, what are you thinking about at this American moment?
Well, I mean, I prefer McCain because I agree with him on more issues, and especially on some of the foreign policy issues. But I would say this. I'm very struck in the last month. When you get in this kind of situation, a post-9/11 world with a huge number of threats, this amazing financial crisis which goes in we don't know what direction, I think the future is very uncertain. You know, honestly, I mean, either one could become president and do all kinds of things that neither of us expect. Obama could become president and save democratic capitalism and stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons. McCain could become president and preside over some horrible catastrophe of democratic capitalism. I mean, who knows? You know, it's really an unusual moment, and it's, I do think in that respect, it's a little like 1932 or 1980, and I don't think people would have been very good at predicting the next 8 years or 4 years in the middle of those campaigns. So I think for me in that respect, I think it allows McCain to say, you know what, no one quite knows what policies we're going to have to pursue in the next few years. It does become a matter more perhaps of character and judgment in this year's choice.
William Crystal, thanks as always. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Neil.
Bill Crystal, editor of the Weekly Standard, a columnist for the New York Times, with us from ABC Radio Studios in Washington. Again, you can find a link to his column, Fire the Campaign, on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Tomorrow, as mentioned, we'll be talking about that line between opponent and enemy. Where do you draw it? Join us again tomorrow. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.